This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, and this is Jennifer Renee, and Jack's on the board tonight. And we want to wish a happy birthday to KPFT. Today, KPFT is 40 years old. Come a long way from the early days of people wanting to bomb us off the air. We're a good group here enjoying this. It's the first of the month, and so we'll have our guest, David Elliott, will be calling in from Washington, D.C. to give us a report on the goings-on in Washington and Congress concerning the healthcare initiative. Then we're going to have Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee will be here. She's a congressman for the 18th District in the House of Representatives. And we're going to talk about not only health, but some of the non-discrimination as well as other civil rights issues. And then we're going to have Tim Brookover from the Houston GLBT Community Center. He is returning from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Creating Change Conference up in Dallas. And he's going to give us a report on all the goings-on up there. And then we're going to have Josephine Titsworth, who is a therapist and a study. But what we're having her here for is the talk about the groundbreaking announcement by the University of Houston indicating that gender identity or expression is included in the non-discrimination policies of the University of Houston system. And if everything goes right, we'll have This Way Out as always. And it looks like we have David.
No. No, we have don't? Our first guest on, which actually is not on that list there.
Oh.
We have Cynthia Robbins, is it Roberts?
Robbins.
She is, and this was sort of a last minute, we found out about this today. She's going to be coming to Houston, and she's with the Census Bureau. Cynthia, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's coming up?
Okay. Well, actually, I'm with a company called Westat, and we are under contract to the Census Bureau.
Okay.
And the Census Bureau has requested that we run focus groups with members of the gay community who are living with their partners. And they are, believe it or not, they are interested in learning about how we think about our relationships and how we answer survey questions about our households. And so we're going to be running focus groups the next couple of nights, and actually Wednesday night and Thursday night. And we are still looking for members of the gay and lesbian community who are living with their partners and who are Spanish-speaking, main language. And we would love to have folks participate.
This is pretty incredible that you're doing outreach into this community.
Well, it is. It's unprecedented, really. I mean, I think we're seeing a sea change in terms of the federal government and their interest in the community. And this is really the first step for the Census Bureau in terms of learning, really, first steps for them, learning how we think about ourselves and how we report ourselves on these forms. So, yeah, it's a big step for the Bureau and for our community as well.
So will these people actually be counted in a separate category?
Not as yet. The current categories on the census, what stimulated this was that there were more people reporting, same-sex couples reporting being married than census thought should be reported in some recent surveys. And so they're trying to figure out, well, surprise, why is that? Why are we reporting that we're married when in a lot of states we can't be? And is there a better category that they can use to account for us? And so it's the first step to figuring out how many of us are out there, where we are, and just representation, really.
So let's give the information about how you'd like people to contact the Census Bureau and where the event is.
You bet. Just for safety reasons, the event will be held at a location near the Galleria Mall on Thursday night at around 5:30. This is March 4th. And if folks are interested in participating, we have a toll-free number they can call, and the contact name there is Allison. The number is 888-330-6233. And there's also an email address they can email to. It's Houston, M as in Mary, A, R as in Roger, the number 4, G as in Gay, at gmail.com. And like I say, we're still looking for folks who are Spanish-speaking in the household, who are living with their partners, and gay or lesbian, doesn't matter. We'd love to have you come out and join us.
Now, this event, especially aiming towards the Hispanic, Spanish-speaking GLBT community. Now, next week, there's going to be another event, and we'll be talking about that on next Monday. And that event is open to the general GLBT community, and that'll be happening at the MCCR Resurrection Church. So we will update you on that information this week, next week. But this week, this event is specifically for the Spanish-speaking GLBT community, correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And we look forward, and I wish you a lot of success.
We look forward to having people join us. Thank you very much, Dad.
Thank you. And, of course, you're listening to KPFT, and we are going to hopefully put David on now.
David, are you there?
Well, I am here, Jack. Can you hear me?
This is Jennifer, and, yes, I can hear you loud and clear.
Well, I'm sorry, Jennifer. I'm really sorry. Who is in the studio tonight?
It's
Jennifer and Jack.
Jack is on the board, and I am in the studio.
Okay. Well, you know, I've got a story that I'd like to tell y'all tonight, if I could.
Now, please do.
I have a story tonight that is personal and poignant and infuriating and invigorating. It has to do with a woman, Texas born and bred, a fierce advocate for healthcare reform and LGBT equality and a bunch of other things that we as progressives believe in. This story involves a woman named Melanie Schaus. Now, let me set the table if I could. Jennifer,
yes.
About a month ago, I got an email message, and I'm just going to read this to you. It read, "Good afternoon. My niece, Melanie Schaus, was recently profiled on your website. I am sorry to say that Melanie lost her battle with breast cancer early this afternoon. We are sad to lose her, but we have promised to carry on the fight for healthcare reform in her honor. Please mention her passing on your website. She touched many lives before she gave her own. Regards, Elizabeth." Now, your listeners may be asking, who was Melanie Schaus? So I'll tell you a little bit about her. She grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas. She went to Texas A&M University. Later on, she moved to San Francisco, and then she went to St. Louis, Missouri, to start her own business. And she had her own business, and she had a health insurance coverage, kind of. Back in 2005, you know, as she was really launching her business, she bought a catastrophic health insurance policy. So that would cover her after she had co-pays and deductibles of $10,000. That means she would have to pay $10,000 before her health insurance kicked in, right?
Right.
So at one point, she found a lump in her breast. And she deferred, you know, she didn't get it checked out because she didn't have health insurance to get it kicked out, checked out, to be honest.
And which a lot of people have that problem in the United States today.
A whole lot of people, particularly in Texas, where one out of every four people is not covered by health insurance, right?
Right.
So by the time she finally got it checked out, you know, the news was bad. The cancer had spread through her body to her bone, lungs, and liver, and it was stage 4 breast cancer. Now, at this point, she had a little bit of health coverage. It's called Missouri's Medicaid program, but it wasn't very, very good. And when her doctors recommended that she had, that she get a certain form of coverage for her breast cancer, her insurance company, her coverage, denied it. And she went on, and on January 30th of this year, she died. You know, before she died, she said, quote, to paraphrase one of my favorite congressmen, Barney Frank, in response to an inflamed teabagger, trying to reason with these insurance company bureaucrats is like trying to talk to a dining room table. Now, there is a woman in Missouri, LaDonna Applebaum is her name. She was a friend of Melanie's. And in an email message that LaDonna wrote, she said, quote, this is right after Melanie died. I hope anyone reading this will call their lawmakers and scream that the health care bill is not dead, but our dear friend is.
Oh,
I know
no.
Melanie wants us to keep fighting as she did. Now, Melanie actually helped plan her own memorial service. She chose to be cremated, wearing an Obama t-shirt, I might add, and she requested that all of those attending her service wear their activist t-shirts. Now, Jennifer, this story could have ended there, but it did not. Three things happened after Melanie's death and after her memorial service that I want to tell you and your listeners about tonight.
Please do.
The first thing that happened is that somehow word of Melanie's death got all the way up to the White House, all the way up to Obama. And President Obama talked about her. And I'm going to read you what he had to say. He was at this rally, and he said, quote, I got a letter. I got a note today from one of my staff. They forwarded it to me from a woman in St. Louis who had been part of our campaign, very active, who had passed away from breast cancer. She had put off having the kind of exams that she needed because she didn't have the right health insurance, right?
Right.
And she had fought a tough battle for 4 years. All through the campaign, she was fighting it. But finally, she succumbed to it. And she insisted that she's going to be buried in an Obama t-shirt. Actually, she was cremated, and she was cremated in an Obama t-shirt.
Oh.
And then Obama went on to say, but think about this. She was fighting that whole time, not just to get me elected, not even to get herself health insurance, but because she understood that there were others coming behind her, who are going to find themselves in the same situation, and she didn't want somebody else going through that same thing. And Obama went on to say, how can I say to her, you know what? We're giving up. How can I say to her family, this is too hard? How can Democrats on the Hill say, this is politically too risky? How can Republicans on the Hill say, we're better off just blocking anything from happening? Obama continued to say, that can't be the message that the American people are delivering. Yes, they're nervous. They're anxious. They're in a tough time right now. The thing they want most are jobs. They really don't like the process in Washington, the sausage making. That part I understand. But I know they don't. But I know they don't want to just offer nothing to the millions of Americans who are in the same situation that this woman, Melanie, was in. That's what we campaigned on. And we are going to keep on working to get it done with Democrats and I hope with Republicans and everybody else in between to bring costs down, to end the worst practices of the insurance industry, to finally give every American the chance to choose quality, affordable health care. We're going to keep on working to get it done. Now, Jennifer, I mentioned that that was one of three special things that happened.
Yes, what's the others?
Well, the next special thing is the online arm of my group. My group is usaction.org, and we have an online arm called truemajority.org. We sent an email message out to our members, and we asked them to send their condolences to a special page we created for Melanie. And what happened, and we also created a Facebook page for Melanie. It's at www.facebook.com/RIP Melanie. And 6,000 people became fans of that Facebook page, and 35,000 people visited our website and left notes of condolences, best wishes. Sometimes they only just sent their name.
That's incredible that you had that kind of response.
And incredible. But Jennifer, it goes even further.
What happened next?
Well, you're not going to believe this, but a group of healthcare reform activists in Philadelphia decided that they were going to march from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. And they named their march, March to the Finish Line for Melanie.
Oh.
And they started their march about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. They went 135 miles from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. The conditions were not optimal. They had to keep marching through snowdrifts, snowbanks, and it wasn't very easy.
Yeah, that had to be the worst time of the year to be making a march in that part of the country.
Well, it was awful. And they came all the way to Union Station in D.C., where we had organized, and when I say we, I say groups like my own, you know, usaction.org and also moveon.org and, you know, some labor unions. We had organized a group of 500 people to greet them. And then we marched the final leg of the way to the U.S. Senate, Congress. And that's, you know, things got really, really exciting. The Senate leadership heard about what we had done. The Majority Leader Harry Reid was there, and other senators were there, like Chris Dodd and Tom Harkin and Sherrod Brown and Bob Casey and Arlen Specter. And we had U.S. Action and True Majority. We had prepared a book called Condolences for Melanie, and where we had gathered everybody's condolences that they had offered, you know, online into one book. And, you know, we gave it to Melanie's life partner, Stephen. And he went on to pass it on to Harry Reid. And Harry Reid, you know, lifted it up at the audience. And he said, and I'm going to give you a quote. He said, quote, "Heartbreaking stories like that of Melanie Schaus occur too often to be ignored. Her battle against cancer and our failing health insurance system reminds us of the cost of inaction. but the courage she chose to live with inspires supporters of reform to keep fighting and never let our result fade. And then we heard from Melanie's partner, Stephen, and he said, and I have to share this quote with you.
Please.
Quote, Melanie would have been alive and well today if we had a healthcare system that worked.
Oh.
She would have gone to the doctor at the first sign of a lump in her breast. The worst thing that can happen to a person happened because of our healthcare system, i.e. she died. And it didn't have to be that way. We need Congress to listen to us, not to listen to the insurance companies.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's so inspiring. David, why don't you tell people what you do for your day job so they can let us know and so they can help you?
Well, I work for U.S. Action, and we're working on quality, affordable health care for all. Our website is at www.usaction.org. You can also join the Melanie Facebook Memorial page by going to www.facebook.com. That's facebook.com/RIP Melanie.
Oh, gosh. Thank you, David. Every first of the month, David Elliott joins us to talk about what's going on in Washington, D.C. And thank you, David.
Thank you so much for having me. God bless. Take care, Queer Voices.
Thank you. And this is Queer Voices.
You're not my judge or my jury. Your friends could find out. That's why you worried. Your image could be spared. Why don't I care? How can I be so unfair? My mind is twisted and you can't explain. How can I live this forsaken way? But I have a news flash for you. I'm never, never, never gonna choose, 'cause it's not contagious, just a little outrageous for you. But it doesn't mean I have any less of a right to be who I am. And I demand to be free from your judgment. Give me the respect. Don't like what I do. Dignity isn't measured by you. Just a little outrageous for you.
But it doesn't mean I have any less of a right to be who I am. And I demand to be free from your judgment. Give me the respect. Don't like what I do. Dignity isn't measured by you. Well, you don't like what I do. Dignity isn't measured by you.
Oh, that was something else. This is Jennifer Renee again, and we have in the studio one of my favorite people, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of the 18th District. And, you know, when you have a guest, especially someone that you have admired, you do a little research, and so that's what I did.
I love it.
And, you know, and I found out some things that I was aware of, but I didn't know. And what, when I was growing up, one of my favorite people was Barbara Jordan. And then I was reading in your bio that you sort of followed in her footsteps, and she was your role model. And there's a connection between us that I didn't know about. But for those of you who don't know, Sheila's in her seventh term as Congresswoman. She originally came from Queens, got her BA in political science from Yale, and then her JD at the University of Virginia, transplanted to Houston when your husband went to work for the University of Houston system, which great system. I was looking at it, and I didn't realize this, that you had had three unsuccessful tries at a judgeship, and then you were appointed a municipal judge,
right,
by
Mayor Whitmire.
Yes, Kathy Whitmire, and I got a chance to meet her for the first time when a niece was sworn in. And then in 1989, you won your at-large seat in the Houston City Council. And then in 1994, you were elected to the 18th District, and you defeated the incumbent, Craig Washington. I am just, that's something else. So, I was looking at, you're on several committee assignments and subcommittee assignments, which we can talk about later, but I want to tell, what's going on right now? What have you been up to?
Wow, that's a mouthful and a plateful, but let me just say I'm delighted to be with you. We have to do this more often. I guess it's because I'm not home during the week that our time has been somewhat distant, but I'm delighted to be here, and there's so much going on. But first of all, of course, I must tell everyone that tomorrow is a primary day, March 2nd, 2010, and I'm hoping that everyone within the sound of my voice that's in the 18th Congressional District will vote for good government tomorrow and vote for someone who has not stopped fighting for this district, and that's me, Sheila Jackson Lee. Now, it's very hard to talk about yourself, and I've found since I've had a primer, which, again, I always look at things as being a gift, as the cup being half full. I've had such a great opportunity shaking hands, going to different groups, telling the story of what the 18th Congressional District is all about. One of the most eclectic districts, so very diverse, from the Independence Heights to the Heights to Fifth Ward, Texas, to the airport, to places in Sunnyside and South Park, to routes out to 90. So there's a lot of work that we do in this district. One issue that is extremely important that I'm engaged in is the whole infrastructure, fixing the infrastructure, working finally to get a mobility system that is befitting of what will be the third largest city in the nation. So I've worked for umpteen years to finally get a metro as a funded project through the president's budget, and we were able to do that by bringing Secretary LaHood of the Department of Transportation in the early moments of the Obama administration to Houston. He got inspired. He saw what we were doing, how good of people we were, and how we had been rejected over the years. And through his work, and he came at my invitation, my advocacy, Metro for the first time got into the president's budget. So now we have $150 million that we already received, and we're now scheduled to receive $1.5 billion to begin breaking ground on the Metro Rail system, which I hope will lead to commuter rail,
yes,
down to Galveston and elsewhere,
right,
to the airport and elsewhere, Baltimoreans can take a train to their airport. Washingtonians and others can take a train to their airport, and many others.
Yep, Atlanta and then, also.
And Atlanta also. And then, ultimately, I hope that we will also get high-speed rail. That's really the excitement that I have is high-speed rail. So that's one of the issues I work on. Today, I was out in Clear Lake because for 12 years I served on the Science Committee, and there may be a lot of NASAites, Johnson Space Center advocates out there. I am rabid about human space exploration, and of course, we took a big hit in the president's budget. Our politics in the governor's office is not the best, and you have to have someone who's advocating from the state to speak to the president and speak to his leadership about what's good for and important for your state. But that's okay. I believe in NASA, the jobs it creates, the science it creates, the International Space Station, and we're going to organize this community to be able to make the point that NASA should be funded, because that is part of the engine of the economy here in this community. So that's one thing. Internationally,
well it's the engine of innovation.
Yes, it
and
is. You're absolutely right.
I grew up with the space program and this original seven astronauts, and because you and I are about the same age, and
yeah, 10 years old.
Yes, I was one or two. But this is something that's important to our nation, to keep up with the technological advances of other nations.
Yes.
Other nations, major nations, are getting into manned space flight. So what are they doing? Why aren't we staying in there with them? So I hope you can do something for us there in Washington.
You asked a very valuable question. All I can say is I believe the president is a supporter, this is my belief, of human space exploration. But he has to deal with budget crunchers and who's the most vulnerable and whose politics probably is not the best.
Right.
And I can say that a secessionist state is probably not showing themselves to be as welcoming as they should be. And so now we have to clean it up. I'm meeting with Bill Nelson, who is a Democrat and a former astronaut from the state of Florida. We feel empowered. We feel like we've got a fight to make and that we can make the fight. And you're absolutely right. We've got a lot of good material to work with. This is the cutting edge of technology and science. These are the jobs of the 21st century. And NASA Johnson and all the other centers are job centers. We don't want to cut jobs. And I think we've got a good message to make to put forward.
Well, for dollar, we get more out of the dollars we spend on the space program, even though it may not seem like it. But we use products that came out of the original space program.
Absolutely.
In the past and today, every day in our kitchen, in our home, the medicines we have are all come from that innovation that the space program
research
brought to us.
Research on stroke. Research on HIV/AIDS, research on heart disease, and research on cancer has been innovative new findings by doing that work in the atmosphere of the International Space Station, which was also built when I was a member of the Science Committee. And I drafted language to ensure that the safety features on the International Space Station equal to what was needed for those individuals, astronauts, who've lived on the space station for 2 and 3 months at a time. I feel very gratified to have been on the Science Committee and been a leader on that issue.
Thank you for that. Thank you. That's been one of my passions from an early childhood age.
Keep advocating.
Yes, and for Houston and the Houston area, it is an engine of money and development. Companies bring here many, many employees there's a possibility, they were saying, maybe 2,000 employees, but it expands to almost 8,000.
Because of the contractors.
That's exactly right.
If you will, the extended arena of impact into the business community.
Absolutely.
And into the economy out in Clear Lake and in Houston. And that leads me to a point when you ask what I'm doing. I'm doing a lot. But what I would say is this is a time when experience does count in Washington, D.C., because there are some very tough political times there. This effort on space, or the human space flight exploration, and dealing with NASA needs someone who has relationships, of which I do, mm-hmm. who's had a 12-year history on the Science Committee, who knows what a CEV is, knows what a Constellation is project, which, by the way, my friends who were or at least one of them who's being interviewed, asked what it was. Constellation is the space program that continues human space flight and continues our journey into space. But more importantly, the idea of working to save NASA means that you've got to know people across the aisle, Republicans and Democrats. I'm part of the NASA Action Team. And also recognize that as you fund NASA, you've got to make sure that other issues that this community needs, education funding for all of our higher education institutions, including Houston Community College. There's just about every single institution that's been in my congressional district has received money, in essence, from me. Houston Community College, University of Houston, Texas Southern University, all of those colleges have received dollars. Then public school dollars, social services. We already mentioned Metro. I was very pleased to provide a grant for MMHRA, the Harris County Psychiatric Unit Hospital, particularly for juvenile beds and juvenile resources, which have been very low. And I'm a big advocate for mental health services, increased mental health services, and was very proud to receive the Mental Health Legislator of the Year from the Mental Health Association of America.
Congratulations.
Because I've been a strong advocate for mental health issues. And so you must keep that balance with the needs of NASA Johnson and all the other NASA efforts, NASA centers around the nation.
When we were talking earlier, and I was going over your list, one of the committees you're on is the judiciary. And I know that there have been two occasions that I can recall right now that you and Chairman Conyers came to Houston. One was about a year ago.
Healthcare, yes.
Yes, and when we had one not too long ago, yes. That was down at the medical center, again on healthcare. Y'all were getting information from doctors themselves. How do we stand on that?
Well, one thing that should be noted is that the Judiciary Committee, interestingly enough, has probably the largest proportion of jurisdiction over matters in the United States Congress of any committee. Because some would say the Judiciary Committee, why is the Judiciary Committee dealing with health issues? But you're right. First of all, we were here advocating for universal access to health care in 676. Mm-hmm. That's a famous bill which was single payer, and we held a hearing at the Medical Museum, a very powerful hearing, talking about the need for reform of the healthcare system, which moved us into a year-long debate, which I'm so sorry that we've taken a year to do this, but we were trying to be open-minded and fair to those who wanted to express their views. We've come to find out now, even after the mayor's, the president's summit, that some people are just going to say no, and we frankly have to overcome the party of no and work on what the American people need. That's 36 to 40 million people. But we also held a hearing just recently on the question of sports injuries, specifically brain injuries, specifically coming out of our oversight of the NFL, which has an antitrust exemption, meaning that no one can compete against them.
Mm-hmm.
And I credit John Conyers, and certainly I'm a senior member. We focused in on what are you doing to protect these players who are out on the playing field and may not have the best equipment or the best attitude about concussion injuries. And we have seen through testimony of these doctors and others who've testified in Washington and Detroit, brain injuries are just devastating. Short-term memory loss. And so we documented with about 15 witnesses that day, documented here in Houston, testimony about the impact of the injuries, in particular the NFL, for example, what happens when a player gets a concussion and there's no response to it. When I say no response, there wasn't the attentiveness that we think that we have generated, changing the rules, talking about a better helmet, taking a player out rather than saying, "Are you okay?" and back out on the field again. Many, many players of yesteryear suffered and still suffer short-term memory loss, various debilitating physical conditions because of that constant pounding of the head, which injured the brain.
Well, not only that, it goes on down to high school.
Absolutely.
Many of the kids, the children who have died on the field has increased over the years under the same circumstances and what are required in the NFL and all. You know, it trickles down to the high schools because everybody wants to protect the athletes.
Well, absolutely, and we did include our high schools as well, and we made sure that the idea of brain injuries did not preclude the idea of other incidences such as respiratory, heart attack, the idea of having students with a physical exam, the idea of having a defibrillator on campus. Our campuses did not have that.
Oh, no.
And so we have made an effort now, and there are some who've lost their child, and they've made it their cause and their effort to be assured that there are those kinds of resources available for high school athletes. We have to look at these individuals as children and young people with futures ahead of them. Mm-hmm. And we need to provide them with all of the safety that they need. With respect to the professionals, we have to indicate that they do play. They make the team, and they also make the game, and they make the profit. If that is the case, then we need to protect them as well.
Absolutely. And one of the things that occurred last week in your committee, the Judiciary Committee, was the passing of the health insurance industry fair
competition,
which takes away the health. Many people don't know that the health insurance companies have an antitrust exemption, just like baseball and football. And the truth is that in 1945, maybe that was a good idea, but today, the way things are, the competition, this is true health insurance reform.
Well, I can tell you that.
Thank you.
Non-competition does not help the consumer. And if I could have a show of hands, if I could actually see who's listening, I'd ask them, how many health insurers were in the state of Alabama? Anybody know the question? Know the answer to that? What about Texas? Big state, you would think, and I bet some of you are calculating 10, 12, maybe 20, 3. How many are in the state of Alabama?
In one. Texas, only three
only
health insurance?
Only three health insurance companies are you allowed to get insurance from. And so what is happening, or what happened, and we're really excited about that, because we forced the vote, and the Republicans could not vote against it. So let's go ahead and get this health care on the plan, on the floor, and dare them to vote against it. We won it overwhelmingly. And what we did is we removed the antitrust exemption, which opens the door. We need to get the bill to the president's desk.
That's right.
Which opens the door to allowing more health insurance companies to compete, and for you, the consumer, to buy at what you can buy, and to make sure it meets certain qualities. And by the way, health care reform is not going to take anyone's insurance away from them, but it is going to give you a floor below which you cannot go. So if you buy an insurance policy, you won't have to be like the lady in my town hall meeting who came crying to the town hall meeting and said, I thought I had insurance. I went to get my son a physical to go to school, and they told me, your insurance is only for the emergency room. So it means get sick, and that's the only time you can see a doctor is for the emergency room. And I got that lady and her son matched up with what we call one of those federally qualified clinics for her to go with a small fee and get her son a physical. She made me cry because people are paying. She said, my husband and I pay on this insurance every month to protect our children. And you mean to tell me we can't even get a doctor's visit? This is the crime of healthcare in America. And you want to see me get animated? Here's my fist on the table. 45,000 people die a year because they have no health insurance. The sad cases of people going to doctors or trying to get insurance, excuse me, and being denied because they have asthma or they have acne. A person with breast cancer or needing to get insurance was denied because they had acne, and that was a pre-existing disease.
That's right. That's right.
And so
I raised my hand. I'm one of those.
Well,
you are
a living witness, as they say. We owe you the human dignity, minimally. If we can go and win all the Olympic medals, and beat on our chest, and I was just as excited as the rest of them.
Absolutely.
And beat out Canada and beat out Germany. And you mean to tell me we cannot have insurance for all of America? I'm outraged. And so I have been an unwavering supporter of the public option. I'm still holding on to it, and an unwavering supporter of universal access to health care and this insurance policy, which will help insure 36 to 40 million. And I hope one of them will be you, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Y'all didn't see how animated she got in here.
Pull my coattails here.
Absolutely. Is there anything else that we have missed that you want to talk about before you get away from here?
I want people to know my heart, and also that Congress can be a forum in which you quietly sit and take your votes and take no hits. But I hope that people will see me as a person that did not go there to be a wallflower, to take no hits, to do nothing that would disturb my electoral success and just be a fly on the wall, a bump on the log, maybe. Mm-hmm. I have fought for hate crimes legislation for almost now a decade plus. When I had to sit in committee rooms and hear the most horrible of things, one of my greatest honors is to, though it was mentioned, is to be mentioned in Matthew Shepard's mother's book. My name is there. Mm-hmm. She met me. She, I think the language is someone told her to see Sheila Jackson Lee, or Sheila Jackson Lee was over there. because we were fighting for hate crimes legislation. We're fighting for ENDA, for example. Which
absolutely.
Is the
I
end,
was going to ask you where
which
we
is
are.
The end. Well, as you well know, we had a meeting with Chairman Conyers with a good group of the community on these issues. And we asked about ENDA. When I left Washington, I just got through signing on to a bill. I'd already signed on to a letter to move Don't Ask, Don't Tell out the way quickly. Now people are trying to backtrack, not the president, but a lot of noise is being put in the way.
Mm-hmm.
You got to take hard voice. Anybody knows David Ritchie? I hosted him in Washington. My heart goes out to his family for what he had to suffer. I named a bill after him and got a major part of that bill put into the hate crimes bill in his honor. I'm sorry it was in his honor.
Right.
I fought since my good friend, Representative Sinfonia Thompson, got the bill passed in the state on hate crimes in the name of the James Byrd horrific tragedy. We then tried to get it done in Washington, D.C. So let me just say that I take the hard votes. I believe there should be no discrimination against anyone on gender,
gender identity.
Gay and lesbian, I was trying to, and bisexual, any form of difference, I'd like to just say difference, should not be engaged in this kind of one-upsmanship. So the question is, tomorrow is election. I just have to say it. I've been taking the hits. I took the hit on Iraq War, but as well, I can work for NASA. I can fight for transportation dollars and housing, and I could darn sure fight for more funding for the Ryan White Treatment Act, and as well for funding for HIV, persons living with AIDS. I can look at this community as a whole and not leave anyone out, give everyone a sense of empowerment, and be able to be someone who can give voice to those who cannot give voice to themselves.
Thank you. We've been talking with Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of the 18th District. And as she reminded, tomorrow is election day for the primaries, both Democratic and Republican primaries. So whichever you want to vote for, get out and vote, because the most important thing is for us to vote.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight. And this is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Torres.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 27th, 2010. Consensual adult homosexual acts are no longer illegal in Fiji, according to a February 26 report in the Fiji Times. The change came through the Crime Decree, which took effect at the beginning of the month and replaced the South Pacific Island nation's archaic criminal penal code. Former High Court Judge Nazat Shamim told the newspaper that the criminal penal code punished sodomy and unnatural offenses, but that there were no such provisions in the crime decree. She added that the removal of the laws against private consensual adult gay sex in the new crime decree was probably inspired by a 2005 High Court ruling by Justice Gerard Winter. Australian tourist Thomas McCosker had been arrested for sodomy while visiting Fiji, convicted and sentenced to 2 years in jail. In overturning his conviction on appeal, Winter ruled that the act of sodomy should not be contained in the laws of Fiji if the nature of the sexual activity was consensual. Unlike the old criminal penal code, crime decree laws against rape also don't specify the gender of the victim. So homosexual acts are illegal only if they are committed without consent. The Fiji Times also said that authorities still have the power to make arrests for indecent behavior in public, though the definition of what is considered indecent was unclear. The new crime decree is also harsher on both female and male prostitution than its predecessor. Religious leaders have strongly opposed the decriminalization of homosexuality. The vast majority of indigenous Fijians are Christian, and Methodists are the largest Christian denomination. Outspoken New Methodist Church pastor Atuneza Bolano called gay people an abomination and suggested that physical punishment should be considered as a way to change their sexuality.
Meanwhile, Australia's Senate defeated a marriage equality bill this week by an overwhelming majority of those present and voting. Only 5 of the 50 votes, all Green Party members, supported the measure. But 26 senators weren't even in the chamber. Some of the Labour and Liberal Party absentees were described as being uncomfortable with the positions of their respective major parties. Both support the federal law defining marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Openly lesbian and gay MPs were said to be in a cabinet meeting or at a meeting in the opposition leader's office. The Greens pledged to reintroduce the bill after this year's elections.
Elsewhere, Britain's Westminster Council has approved the use of the Houses of Parliament for same-gender civil partnerships, as well as non-religious heterosexual civil marriages. It will be the first time civil partnership ceremonies will be held in the Palace of Westminster. Two venues will be available, the Jubilee Room, which overlooks Cromwell Green and has space for 80 people, and the MP's Dining Room, with views of the Thames, which has space for 150. MPs, peers, certain parliamentary officials, and their family members can currently wed at the Chapel of St. Mary in Parliament. Such religious venues cannot be used for civil partnerships or civil marriages, however. Alison Cathcart, Westminster Superintendent Registrar for almost 20 years, has married celebrities including Sylvester Stallone and Joan Collins. She said she was delighted that this prestigious venue has been granted approval, and we very much look forward to conducting the first civil ceremony in such famous and historical settings. Openly gay MP Chris Bryant has already said he wants to be the first to celebrate his civil partnership on Parliament's grounds. He became engaged to his partner, Jared Cranny, last year.
Updating a couple of previous NewsWrap reports, Mexico's Supreme Court has rejected challenges by 3 states to the recently enacted marriage equality law in Mexico City. The states had argued that passage of the law would require them to recognize those same-gender marriages. But the High Court called the challenges inappropriate, saying that one state's laws could not be challenged by other states, nor laws enacted in the nation's capital. The Mexico City law, passed in late December and effective March 4th, gives gay and lesbian families full marriage equality and includes adoption rights. The court has yet to rule on the challenge by a 4th state, Jalisco, which specifically objects to the adoption provision, arguing that children have a right to a family consisting of a mother and father. A 5th state, Sonora, filed a challenge of its own. Federal prosecutors have also targeted the law, claiming that it violates the Mexican Constitution, which guarantees to protect the organization and development of the family. Marriage equality supporters, however, say that the new law will bolster the region's economy. Mexico City's tourism secretary, Alejandro Rojas, told reporters that the capital will become a center where gay people from all over the world will be able to come and have their wedding and then spend their honeymoon here.
And in the U.S., Democrats in West Virginia's House of Delegates this week rejected an attempt by Republicans to advance a proposed state constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriage. The measure reportedly had the support of both majority and minority party leaders. Minority Republican delegates were unsuccessful, however, in trying to force a floor vote on the so-called Marriage Protection Amendment.
There was a lot of buzz on U.S. LGBT websites about an opinion issued this week by the Attorney General in the state of Maryland. Democrat Douglas F. Gansler concluded that the state's highest court is likely to uphold the recognition of same-gender marriages legally performed elsewhere. Democratic Senator Richard S. Madaleno Jr. had requested the opinion from Gansler. "It's reaffirmation of what we thought," Madaleno said, "that Maryland can recognize gay marriage." However, while it was issued by Maryland's top lawyer, it's merely a legal opinion. Even Gansler said in a one-page summary that his conclusion is not free from doubt. Its confirmation would require judicial approval of the recognition in the state of a couple legally wed elsewhere who file a lawsuit after being denied that recognition. Maryland's executive and legislative branches could also weigh in on the issue.
In New Zealand, Prime Minister John Key and other MPs braved the rain to join thousands at Auckland's Big Gay Out on February 14th. Key spent about 2 hours chatting with people and posing for photos. The Prime Minister got up on the stage last year with 2 drag queens and, to the delight of the crowd, showed off his dance moves. Auckland Mayor John Banks helped launch this year's Aroha Festival from the stage, where a variety of singers, bands, comedians, and dancers performed. Entry to the festival was by gold coin donation, with the proceeds going to HIV prevention initiatives. In Australia, hundreds of thousands of locals and tourists participated in or watched Sydney's 33rd annual Mardi Gras parade on February 27th. We'll have more details about that celebration of LGBT pride next week.
In other news, an all-girls boarding school in South Africa shut down its dormitory this week after several of the students were reported to be involved in relationships with each other. Two girls who were caught kissing told school authorities that other girls in the dorm, which houses about 300 students, were also involved in relationships. 27 girls were subsequently expelled from the unidentified school outside Durban in KwaZulu-Natal province. According to local media reports, some of the girls unable to return home have been moved to houses near the school on a temporary basis. South Africa is the only nation in Africa with anti-discrimination laws to protect its LGBT citizens. However, as is the case across the continent, religious and cultural hostility towards sexual minorities remains widespread. But a spokesperson for the nation's education department said the school did not have the right to expel the students based solely on their sexual orientation.
And finally, it's not known how many athletes at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver were gay or lesbian. Flamboyant U.S. figure skater Johnny Weir, dubbed by some as Liberace on ice, got a lot of media attention, but finished sixth in the competition. While there were homophobic remarks made about him by some broadcasters, a few activists criticized him for not specifically coming out as a gay man. But Philip Steenkamp, president and CEO of the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Games, was not shy about his sexual orientation. According to queer media reports, during a reception at Pride House, a venue specifically created for gay and lesbian athletes and visitors, Steenkamp thanked his partner, calling him a true Olympic widow. I really want to thank him for all the support he's given me. An openly lesbian Dutch speed skater, Irene Woest, was golden in the women's 1500-meter race. She also won gold in the 3000-meter event at the 2006 Winter Olympics in Torino, Italy. Then, just 19 years old, she became the Netherlands' youngest ever gold medal winner. I am so proud and happy, Woest told the Washington Post soon after her Vancouver victory. I don't have the words for it, she added. I think I'm the happiest person on earth right now.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 27th, 2010. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Torres.
Join us on Sunday, March 14th, starting at noon, for a party celebrating KPFT's first broadcast 40 years ago. Celebrate KPFT's 40th birthday at the Big Top, McGonagall's Mucky Duck, 2425 Norfolk Street, just off Kirby, featuring performances from Shotgun Party, John Evans, Jack Saunders, Mike Stinson, Guy Forsythe, the Sisters Morales, Greg Trooper, Randy Weeks, the Mighty Orc, Ray Wiley, Hubbard, and more. Again, the event happens on Sunday, March 14th, starting at noon at the Big Top, McGonagall's Mucky Duck, 2425 Norfolk Street in Houston, near Richmond and Kirby. $20 tickets get you in the door. Visit KPFT.org for the complete lineup and more information. This is KPFT Houston.
You listen to KPFT, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial-free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT. But be warned, that fantastic feeling will soon follow. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
You know, I know we should be singing, but we know better than to sing.
Yeah, we should sing happy birthday to KPFT.
KPFT, 40 years old, March 1st, 1970. Really,
but Deb's not here.
Really a universal date to remember. 40 years, mostly 40 years of being on the air. Of course, the station was bombed off twice and had to raise money to put itself back on the air. But it's pretty impressive that we're still here after all these years.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear in the show before ours, in Interchange, Tony was telling that story about someone who was ex-Klan came in and made a donation in honor of 40 years.
I think there was more to that story, but I didn't quite get it all.
Well, that's enough. It was the point being made that things have changed, and a lot of hearts and minds have changed because KPFT is here. So keep us on. Well, this is Jennifer Renee, and we have in our studio Tim Brookover, one of our guests that comes in many times. He is president of the Houston GLBT Community Center.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there. And you were in Dallas recently for
yes.
the Creating Change Conference, and
yes.
many people may not know what that is. Would you tell us a little more about it?
Sure. Creating Change is an annual leadership conference that is organized by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, one of the prominent national GLBT rights organizations. It's an annual event. It's held in a different city in the United States every year. This year it was held in Dallas, and I had always told myself that if it came to Texas or nearby, I would like to go and participate. I had never had a chance to do that before, and this year it was in Dallas, and so went up there and had a very interesting experience. Was at the I think it's the Sheraton the Sheraton downtown, which is an enormous hotel, if you've ever been there. And it's about 2,000 queers from across the nation, which is quite a sight to see.
I
we really
bet it was.
Took over the hotel. But very exciting. There are, workshops and sessions and plenary sessions with speeches and just all kinds of events throughout the 4 days, as well as, of course, lots of networking and, things happen, people talking in the hallway and meeting and greeting, and it was exciting to be there.
What is occurring in the event? I mean, Creating Change, there's the seminars and speakers, and like most other conferences, What was the purpose that they want to bring out of it? What did you bring home with it? I guess the best question.
It's billed as the largest leadership conference in the GLBT community.
Okay.
So it really focuses on leadership in the community, which kind of playing across different areas. Of course, focusing on political organizing.
Okay.
And community organizing. But, you had a real range, which reflects the spectrum of the community. Everything from a lot of workshops focusing on youth, as well as older Americans in the community. A lot of workshops on focusing on transgender issues, issues related to people of color and different cultural identities. A number of different workshops on, how-to workshops. I mean, how to, organize a, political campaign or a political movement. How to work with volunteers. A lot of different seminars aimed at people who are involved in organizing are maintaining community organizations. So you've got working with volunteers, working with boards, working with fundraising. Of course, fundraising is always a big component.
Yeah, dialing for dollars.
Exactly.
Yes,
how you do that. The first couple of days of Creating Change is given over to what the task force calls institutes. They're day long intensive workshops related to different topics. I went up a day early for a day-long community center institute.
Oh, good.
Which was held actually at the Resource Center of Dallas, which is their community center.
Right.
Which is very successful, have a wonderful facility in the Oak Lawn area. And they're actually building or in the, preparing, getting prepared to build a brand new facility not too far from their current facility. So that's exciting. So that was good. I went and participated in that. It was a little disorienting for me because the community center here is it's all volunteer, grassroots at this point still, relatively small compared to community centers in a lot of other urban areas mm-hmm. in this country. And a number of the other community centers that were represented at this day-long institute are much larger than our center, led by the Los Angeles Gay Lesbian Community Center, which has a $40 million a year budget.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's a lot of fundraising,
it's
too.
It's a lot of fundraising. And, of course, when you're that size, you have problems that a community center our size can't even begin to imagine. So I'm not necessarily envious of them.
Their electric bill is probably more than the budget
exactly,
here.
Exactly. So, you know, in some ways, that day, they were dealing in, the participants were dealing with issues that we don't really deal with yet. But that's okay. You know, you aspire, you learn what you can. It was interesting, there was a woman who was there. I can't remember her name, but she's from Iowa. And she started a community center in Des Moines,
okay,
Iowa. And she had some experience working in kind of with Iowa's equality organization, Iowa's equivalent of, I guess, of Equality
right.
Texas.
Yeah.
So she's not a complete, you know, neophyte at this, but she has started this community center. It's only 8 months old. So she and I were laughing at one point when we were comparing notes during a coffee break. It's like, you know, we can't necessarily identify
with something that has a $40 million budget.
But, you know, it's very exciting that those centers are out there, that there is
a community
center. Or there are, you know, the center in New York, or there's a very large center in Reno, and there are a couple of very large centers in Florida. So that's very, you know, that, and of course the Resource Center in Dallas is very successful. You know, so it's great to know that those facilities are out there to give you something to work toward. But, you know, when you get up to have a $40 million budget, you're dealing in sort of a different reality than an organization that has a $30,000 to $50,000 a year budget.
Right. Well, you have staff problems,
and they talked a lot about staff issues and issues of staff dealing with interfacing with volunteers and your volunteers interfacing with the board of directors and you know.
Different issues. Said we don't have that problem.
We don't have any of those problems. We're the staff. We're the volunteers. We're the board. but it's okay. It was, and everybody there was just incredibly nice and you know and very accommodating and I made some great contacts with people, some of whom I'd met before. There's a national organization of GLBT community centers. It's called CenterLink.
Okay.
And they actually put on this institute with the task force.
Okay.
And they're, you know, there's some great people. And I actually met some terrific guys from the GLBT community center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, of all places.
Tulsa? Okay.
And that's actually part of Oklahoma's equality organization, which I think is called Oklahoma Equality, which is very active. And they have then they also have a community center in Tulsa, which is all volunteer, but it's very large. So I had a great conversation with them, and actually we're planning to do at some point to do a road trip because I'd like to go up there and learn a little bit about what they do and how they've gotten to where they are because they own a facility, and a lot of the organizations in Tulsa, not just GLBT organizations, but use their facilities. So they really have, you know, I think a pretty dynamic community center up there in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Who knew?
No. Well, we're the fourth largest city in the country. You know,
right.
You know, when we see these other organizations, we need to go. We all need to get out and work harder to build our own community
and
have a community center that's similar to some of those.
Work harder and keep learning, and that was another great thing about being at Creating Change, not just the day-long Community Center Institute, but getting a chance to go to some of the other workshops. And learning, meeting people. Of course, it's like any convention you go to. There's always much more to do than you could possibly.
Oh, always.
Do. And so you miss a lot of things that you might like to do, but you have to pick and choose.
Yeah.
But
especially when they have two or three things at the same time.
Always. There's always, oh, I want to do that. No, I want to do that. You just have to make choices, and makes. Made some great contacts. There was a great workshop that actually the volunteer coordinator at the Dallas Resource Center gave about working with volunteers.
Right.
And she gave out some materials, which was very valuable. We were all grabbing those materials, their volunteer manual and their volunteer guidelines, which she was very generous to hand those out. And people were saying, can we use these? And she said, sure. We all borrow from one another. Uh-huh. So that was very generous. But that was a great workshop because you got some great, sort of concrete information about working with volunteers and kind of building your volunteer base. So there was some real, kind of hardcore technical information.
Something you could take home with you and bring
absolutely,
back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're talking with Tim Brookover, president of the board of the Houston GLBD Community Center.
Yeah, and so Creating Change was great, and I would encourage people in the community who think they might be interested to go Google the task force or use the search engine of your choice, and National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and get on their list. Mm. Next year, the conference, Creating Change, is in Minneapolis.
At the same time of year?
At the same time, so it'll be cold.
Ooh, yes, it will. I have friends up in Minneapolis now.
It'll be icy, but it is an exciting time. I think it's definitely worth looking into. I would also encourage a lot of the young people in our community, and we have some, great young dynamic activists, to take a look and try to get up there, because that was one of the exciting things about Creating Change this year, at least for me, and I had never been before, but the number of young people who were participating and taking leadership roles, in the conference and actually holding workshops. That was great to see.
Gay and Lesbian Task Force has always been very active, and I had the opportunity about 4 years ago to go to their training,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
was just terrific.
Yeah,
if you're ever thinking about being an activist or being active,
they're great.
Even if you don't want to be an activist, you just want to be active and to get something accomplished, it's excellent.
Yeah, they're a great organization and they have great training programs and actually there were some very intensive in these day-long institutes I mentioned. There was a very intensive track for sort of like training people to be a board member for an organization, whatever your organization might be, or, really some intensive training. And that was one of the things I was also interested in, but it was the same day as the Community Center Institute.
Oh, of course. That's,
so of course, you have to make a choice.
Exactly.
But they offer some really good, I think, some good training. So I would encourage people to take a look, and as I said, next year will be in Minneapolis, and they've probably chosen the year after that. They'll probably go, maybe they'll go someplace a little warmer.
Yeah, Florida or something. Talk about our local community center. What's going on and what's up here?
Well, we're really
Can we get involved?
Thank you. We're having a very exciting year. We're doing some rebuilding, some revitalization
under new leadership.
Under some new leadership, we've got some new board members and some people who aren't yet on the board. But everybody doesn't have to be a board member, but are friends of the center and are helping bring it along. We're really dedicated to programs and activities serving the community, working on some very positive collaborations with other organizations, including Unhinged Productions, the theater company, and QFest, the film festival, as well as some other groups that we're still talking to. We have some new programs coming up, or some new programs that we've implemented.
Right.
And one of them, is which has become very successful, is the third Tuesday of the month, we have a potluck for GLBT seniors in our community.
Oh.
Which has become incredibly successful and really great fun. It's organized by the Community Center, and it's hosted by Bethel Church, United Church of Christ, which is one of the really affirming congregations,
right,
in our community,
right,
over on Shepherd. And they have a fellowship hall with a big kitchen, and so we have it there on the third Tuesday, and that's great fun.
What time does that usually start?
6:30 on the third Tuesday,
okay,
of every month. This month, it'll be on the 16th, so it falls the day before St. Patrick's Day, so we're going to have a little St. Patrick's Day action.
Green thing?
Little green stuff, some corned beef and cabbage, some potatoes. Last month, the potluck happened to fall on Fat Tuesday, so we had a little Mardi Gras theme, which was great fun. We had some New Orleans food, so that's really great. We also have a new reading series that we've implemented, the Community Center Reading Series. Our first program was in January. We're starting out, the way it's working out is going to do it every other month, and we're going to build up to monthly.
Okay.
So this month it's March 18th, and our author is a woman named Micaiah Hart from California, who has written a memoir called My Sweet Wild Dance, and it's nominated for a Lambda Literary Foundation Award.
Oh, wow, wonderful.
And so that'll be the 18th at the Montrose Freed Library on Montrose. This is a partnership with the Houston Public Library, which we're very excited about. It starts at 6:30, so we hope people come out. And like most of our programs, it's free.
Tell us how to get in touch with you. Give us all the details.
Our it's the Houston GLBT Community Center. Our website is www.HoustonGLBTCommunityCenter.org, or just the initials HGLBTCC.org. You can our website, email address, HoustonGLBTCenter@gmail.com. Our phone number, 713-524-3818.
Thank you. We've been talking with Tim Brookover, president of the board of the Houston GLBT Community Center. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
This is Queer Voices.
So he's holding me in his arms, and he's giving me sweet little kisses, and he's telling me he'll never harm me, and he's whispering how wonderful this is, and I tell him that I love him, and I tell him I'll be true, and I've said these things to other boys, but right now the old words feel so new. And I ask him, how did I get so lucky? Didn't even have to try. I don't know, he says, I'm nothing special, I'm just some guy. And he's smiling like he means it, and he's stretched out on his back, and he's telling me now that he loves me for the fifth or the sixth time, I can't keep track. And I watch his eyes as they shine, run my fingers through his hair, and I touch his chest where his heart is, and I tell him I find safe haven there. And I ask him, how did you get to be so sweet and so kind? So sweet and so kind. I don't know, he says, I'm nothing special, I'm just some guy. And I say, your heart is so big, and your mind so alive, your mind so alive. You have passion and freedom.
on my skin, and I'm happier now than I've ever been. And I'm hoping this feeling won't die. And if he says he's just some guy, that's fine. The truth is, he's mine. My sweetheart, my love, sent down from the sky, sent down from the sky, so very much more than just some guy.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee. And we're have our guest in here, Josephine Tisworth, LMSW, that's a licensed Master of Social Work. She's also a PhD student at the University of Houston. But most importantly, she is, by my reckoning, the most active individual striving for sexual orientation, gender identity acceptance within the University of Houston. Tireless worker who took up the task at University of Houston Clear Lake to make sure that the transgender students had a fair shake and were treated equally on campus, and it's expanded even more. And that's why I asked Josephine to come on, because there was an important announcement made. A memo was put out by the University of Houston to the entire system concerning their interpretation around the Lopez versus River Oaks Imaging case that has brought to the spotlight to gender identity expression as it relates to sexual stereotyping. Did I get all that right?
You're on track.
Okay. Well, that's why you're here.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this.
Well, I'd like to kind of give you a little background so you can understand what this
do.
Is really about. There's a case law that exists, and this is published case law that lawyers use whenever they go to court. Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins was the case law that was published where there was a woman who worked for a corporation, I believe.
Price Waterhouse.
And she was qualified to receive an upper executive position within that corporation.
But she was denied that for something. I don't remember the entire story, but she was denied the advancement.
Correct.
Because
she wasn't feminine enough.
Now, was she gay or something?
She just wasn't. She didn't act like a woman.
She wasn't frilly enough.
She wasn't frilly enough.
Okay.
She didn't dress like a woman, is what they interpreted a woman should be. And okay. So they denied her that.
A bunch of guys decided what she should be.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Got it.
And so they denied her that promotion based on the grounds that she just wasn't feminine enough. And so she sued them.
Okay.
And the courts ruled in her favor on the grounds of the Title VII of 1964 Civil Rights Act that you cannot discriminate against someone based on their sex.
Okay.
And so they're saying that you can't discriminate because someone's not feminine enough or masculine enough. Well, that is a foundation for some current law that's being used in the courts right now.
Now, I remember bits and pieces, but what they said was that, in fact, they had around sex. It was sexual stereotyping.
Yes.
They determined in that case that that was illegal.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right.
And so in the District Circuit Court 6 a few years ago, and without looking at my notes, I'm guessing it was around 2005, 2006. I think it was 2005. Federal District Court 6 ruled in favor of a transsexual on the grounds that this person wasn't acting masculine enough. And
okay.
So it was based on the sexual stereotype.
Again.
Case. Again.
All right.
And so the transsexual won the case against the corporation they were suing with. So we had a case law now. We have case law in federal district court that's published, and the lawyers can use this as precedent when
okay.
they go to court. Now, there is a Lopez case.
So we jump ahead in time because this is over the last, 20 years, something like that?
Basically, the last 20 years.
Of case law building from Price Waterhouse
yes.
to here locally when Issa Lopez
mm-hmm.
applied for a job with River Oaks Imaging. So
correct.
Take the story from there.
She applied for the job with River Oaks Imaging. Now, I understand Issa Lopez had not gone through the legal procedures to have legal name change or gender marker change, none of the legal stuff at
okay.
that time.
Right.
But when she did her application and everything, she put her male name, she put her femme name that she went by at the time.
Mm-hmm.
She interviewed in the gender she perceives herself, which is female.
And as in the Issa Lopez.
Issa Lopez.
Okay.
We're talking about a male to female transsexual.
Mm-hmm.
And so she interviewed there, and she made it clear to everybody, I am a transsexual, and I was born male, I live female. And so River Oaks Imaging, on a verbal word, said that you're hired. We will hire you.
She was qualified for the job, passed the interview, and so they hired her.
They hired her. And so she went off, left, thinking, okay, next week I can come to work. Well, a week after they verbally hired her, she received a letter in the mail that said, we are withdrawing this offer. You misrepresented yourself as a female, and you're not. But all the documentation proves that she did not do that. She did not do as they claimed in that letter. And so the ACLU and Lambda Legal got involved with her. And they went to court. Now, my understanding is they actually settled out of court. And so the judge ruling was based on what that settlement was.
Mm-hmm.
And is she how could I put this? The ruling said that because of the hard evidence she had the documentation and everything, it wasn't based on a preponderance of evidence, but on some hard evidence that she had been discriminated against due to stereotyping.
Sexual stereotyping.
Yes.
Right.
And so she won her case because of discrimination against sex. The
okay.
word sex.
The word sex.
Yes.
Now, okay, so that takes us in. We have this solid case here
mm-hmm.
locally
yes.
where, again, this only reinforced the decision in Price Waterhouse and other follow-up.
Yes.
So how do we get to University of Houston now?
Well, in 2003... I was asked by the Dean of Students at University of Houston Clear Lake to start this process to get gender identity expression in the non-discrimination statement. And
at the University of Houston Clear Lake.
Right, that's
okay.
where it started. And a team of us got together and we strategized and we put it through the policy change process. And it's all culminated down to this one memo 7 years later where we sat at the table with the University of Houston System General Counsel.
Let me...
okay.
If I understand it, to follow the thinking, you got it passed down at U of H Clear Lake.
Yeah.
So U of H Clear Lake Each university, each college mm-hmm. is separate in its own entities. But you had it passed down there.
Yes.
And it was signed off on and added to non-discrimination at the University of Houston Clear Lake.
No.
No? Okay.
President Staples signed off on it.
Okay.
Which said, okay, we approve this. But it was halted. And it did not get implemented.
Okay.
Because it was moved to UVA system legal, where it rested.
For a while.
Yes.
Looks like, what, 6 years? Something like that.
Actually,
Until
Lopez came along, and it's been sitting there until we got this memo.
Okay.
Which was last month. No, January. Yeah. Last month was February.
Yeah, it's March 1.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I woke up this morning thinking it was the 29th. But, now, the memo, what's important about this memo is that, if I understand, the U of H has agreed that that is, in fact, the truth, that gender identity expression is, in fact, protected under current U of H provisions? Or am I getting that all wrong? And if I please straighten it out.
You're doing fine. This memo... this is one of the significant. This is part of the significance of the memo,
okay.
Is that it identified and let us know that there's been a paradigm shift within the University Houston system, culturally, to where the University Houston system now recognizes the transgender students, faculty, and staff as a protected class, as a group of people who need the attention of the university. Whereas before, we were really basically invisible, no one wanted to hear about it, and this kind of stuff. This created a paradigm shift where the culture changed within the system. And so now, instead of being invisible, we are a part of the system and we're recognized as being in the system. But there's still drawbacks from this, but that's...
Well, it doesn't go far enough,
exactly.
And there's not the language within a non-discrimination policy mm-hmm. that says gender identity or expression or transgender, whatever it mm-hmm. might be. But what they're saying is in this memo, because I was understanding this memo went everywhere throughout the U of H system to everyone, putting everyone on notice that transgenders exist and that they are protected. So, I got that right?
That was the intent.
Okay, that's the intent. So what's the practical...
Yeah, as you know, you sat in on some of these meetings.
Yes, I did.
And so they were supposed to send this memo out to all the other three universities besides the central campus, which is Clear Lake, downtown, and Victoria.
Right.
And it was supposed to send out notice that... they're not going to tolerate discrimination against transgender student, faculty, staff.
Right. Okay.
My contacts at the different campuses have informed me that they haven't heard a word about this except what I told them.
Oh.
See, breaking news, folks.
Ding, ding, ding. Because this is dated January 8th. I have a copy of it here in front of me. January 8th. And let's see... And it's saying to the vice president, associate vice president, assistant vice president, executive directors, deans, and department chairs.
Yes.
That seems to cover everybody.
Yeah, but does it trickle down to those that are actually...
doing the discriminating.
Yes.
Okay.
And based on feedback I've gotten from the different campuses, it has not trickled down.
Now, when you say that, though, I mean, is there actual cases of discrimination out there ongoing? Or is it one of those passive discriminations that, you know, we're just invisible?
Well, it's like I told the general counsel one day at one of our meetings. They made the statement that if there's faculty, staff, or student discriminated against for being transgender, and they hear about it, they're going to enforce the rights of that transgender individual. And my response to him was, is most likely you will never hear about it, because it's just as was in my case early on in 2005 when I was faced with discrimination.
Right.
The administration was telling me, don't do anything, don't do anything. And so they would never hear about it. And so I didn't do anything. And this is what I was trying to get across, is the general counsel may never hear about this.
They may not hear about the actual discrimination,
yes,
because it's kept quiet. It's
yep.
very much like HISD, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. My ongoing battle,
yes,
with HISD.
Exactly, yeah. But this, here's this.
But this is a profound step forward.
Yes.
Now, I don't want to diminish it, because we've been talking about, you know, it has its shortcomings.
Yes,
because
it does.
The idea and the principle is there, and it's in writing.
Yes.
The interpretation of Lopez the River Oaks Imaging, that whole setup, Price Waterhouse. This is a precedent that the general counsel of the University of Houston system has interpreted as this is where it is. So this is a profound step forward. But the practicality of it is it's not reaching all of the people.
No, it's not. The general counsel is clearly stated in our meetings that they believe that transgender people are covered under the word sex. And so where we have our problem is that if a transgender person is discriminated against and they're going to sue for discrimination,
mm-hmm,
they can't sue because they're transgender. They have to sue because of this
sexual stereotype.
Yes.
Ah, okay. If somebody wants to get involved, where do they go? What do they do? Well, somebody's out there and says, that just irritates me. What can I do? What do you tell them?
Well, I would tell them, says, let's get involved with the Texas Transgender Non-Discrimination Summit that we have every year.
Okay, when is that going to be?
We've reserved spaces at Rice University for July 20th and 21st this summer.
Okay. If people want to get some information on that, where would they go? How could they get to it?
Well, they could email me or email you.
Okay. Thank you. What is your email address?
social_worker@juno.com.
Okay. And anything else that we've missed that you want to close with?
It's just, we need the language so that it's very clear that the transgender population is a protected class, and that the word sex is just too broad and yet too narrow in both ways.
Well, and I understand, but was it the fifth edition of the... what is that? The book, the psychiatrist book. What is it? What's the initials on that thing?
The DSM.
DSM, number
DSM
five.
DSM-4, TR, five is still in production.
But the fifth one, they have substituted gender in the place of sex.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. We've been talking with Josephine Tisworth, and we've been talking about a profound change in the perspective concerning transgender people at the University of Houston system. This is Queer Voices.
Was the 1991 documentary Paris is Burning an accurate depiction of house ball culture or a misleading stereotype of the community? The contemporary urban black and Latino queer youth scene in the U.S. was born at the intersection of Reagan-era doldrums and the advent of hip-hop. However, its roots go back much farther than that, as Twin Cities Black Pride chair, actor, and health education outreach worker Ernest Simpkins tells our Minneapolis St. Paul correspondent Dixie Trichel.
Most people know of the house ball scene and the house ball community from the movie Paris is Burning. But the house ball community sort of began during the Harlem Renaissance and there was a lot of things going on, and there was a publication that began during that particular time called Fire, and Langston Hughes and people like Zora Neale Hurston was involved in that process. But what changed down the years is that the house ball scene began to build a lot more infrastructure than it had been. Back in the Harlem Renaissance, there was a big focus on the drag community, pageantry and things of that nature. And so as time went on, there began to have this need to create more infrastructure, as I mentioned, and that infrastructure became the house. And they particularly became a big need because what they were finding is that, and even to this date, young Black and Latino LGBT people have been ostracized from their family, kicked out from their homes, and homeless. And so the houses sort of became a space. The houses became their family, and each house had a house mother and a house dad, and many people likened the houses to sort of sororities and fraternities. But instead of having sort of a Greek name, most house ball houses take on a designer name. Like there's the House of Prada, the House of Blahnik, and there was actually a house that was named after Willie Ninja, who performed in Paris is Burning. He was also in the music video Vogue from Madonna.
Oh, okay.
And many people don't really know that voguing came from Black gay folks, and it became like this art form, and it got to the mainstream through Paris is Burning and through Madonna's Vogue, but it's still very much a part of the house ball community to this date.
If you go back into the Harlem Renaissance days, they were costume balls, right, and many times did include both women and men who were in drag, at least for a while in the 30s, the gender fluidity did exist, and now it sounds like it's coming back into that.
One of the interesting things about the shift that the house ball community has sort of taken throughout the years is the influence of hip-hop, and how when, you know, the whole hip-hop movement began to emerge, it began to redefine gender roles. Like, no longer were you just talking about masculinity, but you were talking about hyper-masculinity. So raising the bar in masculinity, and how the house ball community began to respond is, for people that may or may not know about what the house ball scene, it's sort of a fashion show meets gender nonconformity. Different houses compete, and they walk depending on what category. So what the hip-hop movement began to do was introduce new categories. So it was no longer Butch Queen realness, or Butch Queen is sort of the name for a biological male who performs from either more masculine way to a feminine way. And femme queens are usually transgendered. The hip hop movement introduced realness, realness with a twist. It's sort of this walk where, you know, you have this really masculine, hyper-masculine gay male come down the runway, and all of a sudden some house music comes on, and they're voguing, and they're dipping, and they're duck walking, and it challenges the way we perceive gender. They play with how gender is performed. They've mastered it, and the reality is that for many of us, we have had to perform gender roles for acceptance of our family, for acceptance of society. We had to put more masculine walk or more masculine talk, you know, when we're around certain people. And the house ball, you can be and do whatever you want to. All the gender conformity goes out of the window.
Twin Cities Black Pride Chair Ernest Simpkins talked about house ball culture with This Way Out correspondent Dixie Trichel.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
Uganda's proposed anti-homosexuality bill has been at the top of the news for weeks, but LGBT advocates are engaged in significant battles all over Africa. Zimbabwe, Cameroon, and Namibia were among the countries discussed during a special Radio Netherlands program hosted by Jonathan Gruber.
I'm joined by Scott Long from Human Rights Watch in New York, and Ian Swartz, who's a gay rights activist who grew up in Namibia and now lives in South Africa. And we're hearing a lot at the moment from opponents of gay rights who state that homosexuality is simply not African, period. Here's a clip from an Anglican bishop in Cameroon.
It is condemnable, and I agree with that. It is horrible for us in our African tradition. It is horrible.
Well, Ian, you're African. What do you make of what the bishop said there?
Well, I do think that as Africans, we do tend to be very selective in how we perceive our cultures and our moralities, etc. And people do sometimes tend to want to look at it as this big monolithic block, something that you can't change. And, you know, it's set like that, it's been like that for a million years, and it is never going to change. And, of course, that is completely untrue. When you look at different African settings, that culture is so diverse, and how people define themselves and their culture is so diverse, that I think talking about the African culture has also just become another convenient way in which we can dismiss everything that we don't like.
Scott, what do you think of what the bishop there said?
The purpose of this rhetoric and the purpose of these moral panics is to divide societies and to demonize certain people, to cast them out by saying they're not part of the constellation of African values at all. And what we need to remember is that politically, individually, and also in terms of public health, this demonizing of people has a devastating effect. I mean, it destroys people's lives.
Well, let's talk about just how deep the roots of anti-gay sentiment in Africa go. I'm going to play a clip for you now from a gay man called Alexander, and he lives in Zimbabwe. And he's talking about what would happen if he ever came out to his family.
In my society, people believe that a gay person is so bad that they even deserve to die. And maybe if a homosexual gay person died, they'll say, ah, it's good for him, it serves him right. After all, he was quite an embarrassment to us, or something of that sort. If I personally, as an individual, came out to my family, they'll go on to say, look at this young man who's had an evil spirit cast upon him. They want to run around with me across to the witch doctor, and the witch doctor says, an aunt who lives across the river bewitched your son, you've got to give him this concoction. And as they cook their food, they're trying to put herbs in their food, maybe trying to help. The way African people fear evil spirits and evil spells makes them think that a homosexual person is a person who's got a demon or something of that sort.
And then there's Lorenzo's story. Lorenzo is a young man in his early 20s from Cameroon, and one day he met another man, and well, they clicked.
Bon, je sais pas si mon marche me rappelle plus la date, mais je connais.
I don't remember the exact date that all of this happened. I met a young man who was called Yannick, and we went to this disco where we had a few drinks and a lot of fun.
Quelque chose s'est éclaté un peu. Le lendemain matin,
but the next morning, I went to my beauty salon because I'm a hairdresser. He came and he said he wanted to be with me. So we went out to find a flat together. And we found this place where we discussed the rent with the landlady. And it was about 53,000 francs a month. That's around 80 euros.
Lorenzo was excited to have found someone he really liked and who wanted to share his life with him. His joy was short-lived.
Mais j'étais surpris alors que Daniel,
I was surprised the following day when Yannick's brother-in-law came to my beauty salon together with two policemen. And they said, are you Lorenzo? And I answered, yes, I am.
J'ai dit, c'est moi. Ils, bon,
and they asked me là, if I knew Yannick.
Connaissais certain Yannick.
Then they accused me of hiding him in my place, and they started threatening me verbally. So I called Yannick up, and he came over immediately. The police then just took him away.
Mardi? J'ouvre mon salon de coiffure, ils viennent, deux policiers.
The next day, the police came back, with the landlady this time, and they said, we've come back to arrest you for abusing minors and homosexuality. I was flabbergasted. I didn't know what to do. And then they jailed me.
There was no trial, but Lorenzo was jailed for 7 months. Six others got the same sentence.
We didn't know each other beforehand, but we got to know each other in prison. We see each other from time to time now because unity is strength. They're my friends, so I can't turn my back on them, and they can't forsake me either. They're like family to me because we lived through the same experiences for 7 months.
Je les prends comme ma famille. Et oui. Les conditions de la prison, ça a été.
It was really hard. We were tortured, we were insulted and threatened, and they tried to rape us. It was really hard for us. We couldn't leave our cell to get some fresh air because we were afraid that the bad guys inside would just hurt us. They treated us as if we were different. Some of the guards made fun of us, and we often had to go to the prison director's office to try to resolve the problems, for they thought because we were gay, we didn't have a right to live, and that we deserved to go to hell.
C'est l'enfer que nous mérite. Oui, oui. Quelqu'un prisonnier comme
and when the prisoners saw us in the courtyard, even if we didn't say anything, they would say that we'd attack them verbally, and they would threaten us, they'd call us women, ugly women, that type of thing. And they were constantly calling us faggots.
Pédé, comme on le dit.
They said, we shouldn't go out. They said, you've got to stay in your cell. They hit us and they threw water on us. Really, we couldn't leave our cell. So we were in a prison within a prison.
C'était de la prison dans la prison. Oh, oui, oui. Eh oui. C'est tout.
Lorenzo in Cameroon. Scott, are there a lot of gay people being charged and arrested and imprisoned throughout Africa?
All the signs are yes. In most countries, we don't know how many, and we don't know the scope of the arrests. I think what happened in Cameroon is very typical of this phenomenon, the kind of panics that have been happening all over Africa. In 2005, a Cameroonian newspaper started outing what it said were 55 prominent gays in government and business, and it seemed to be a politically motivated attempt to go after one ethnic group or members of that group. And it was a big scandal in the media, but it sent a message to local police officers across the country that a route to career advancement and getting their name in the papers was to go after the gays. And we have seen in Cameroon, Human Rights Watch is finishing a report on this now, we've seen repeated arrests of groups of gay men and lesbians and transgender people over the last 5 years, with the predictable effects in feeding public fears and prejudices, and also having a devastating effect on the national response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic.
Ian, what about at the time when you were starting your Rainbow Project? Now, when you were first getting that on the ground in Namibia, I mean, you were doing that for a specific reason, I guess. That's very
right. When Sam Nujoma was really making this horrible statement, I just could not see him is getting away with it and nobody speaking out against it.
And this was the president of Namibia at the time?
This was the president of Namibia. There was at that stage the Minister of Home Affairs who then called for the elimination of gays and lesbians, and it just went all over the place. It was beyond craziness for a while. So many people who could afford left the country, which I think was very scary. And
in the midst of all of this, you became an outspoken gay activist.
Well, I didn't really feel that I had much of a choice. And I think...
Well, it couldn't have been the safest choice.
It wasn't the safest choice, but sometimes that is not your consideration. Sometimes you need to think about a bigger picture. And to me, it was truly that. It was a country that I loved, a country which is... You know, that shortly before had gained its independence, a country that I felt could still go the right way, and it was going to be very important that people that were Namibian, that were not white, that could proudly identify as gay, that those people could speak up.
And was it dangerous for you to do that? I mean, did people threaten you?
Well, yes, there were many threats. I can remember the very first time the SWAPO Youth League, and SWAPO, of course, is the ruling party in Namibia, the SWAPO Youth League threatened to burn down the very newly established offices of the Rainbow Project. How we absolutely had to flee and weren't quite sure what it was that we were going to come back to. And my colleague Carol, you know, grabbing every piece of paper she could possibly find with everyone's name on it, because by then we had said to people, listen, we need to have your contact details, and we promise that we will guard these with our lives. And so when people were threatening to storm into our offices and burn everything, we had to every time grab the most sensitive information, which we kept together, which were people's contact details, their names, etc., and then flee with those. And that happened a couple of times. And there were, and because of that, I actually, at some point, decided to move. I decided to make the move to behind a higher wall with the electrical wiring, which is something that I never wanted to do. But it did make me feel a lot safer. But it also made me realize at times how much of an outcast I was in my own country.
Well, Ian, we have to leave it there for the moment, but you should definitely stay listening, because we will be speaking with somebody who is, in fact, trying to make the best of being gay and living in Africa, and who tries to live as openly as possible.
Jonathan Gruber's Radio Netherlands look at gays in Africa continues next time on This Way Out. In the latest LGBT news from the continent, Agence France-Presse reports that Malawi officials have announced a widespread effort to hunt down key figures in the country's gay community. Police responding to a robbery at the office of the LGBT Center for the Development of People confiscated the group's membership information and what they described as pornographic films. Meanwhile, a Malawi gay couple is still in prison after being arrested in late December for hosting a public engagement party. They face up to 14 years in prison for gross indecency. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, John Torres, Dixie Trichel, and Daryl Stevens contributed program material. Thanks also to Steve Pride and to Jonathan Gruber and Eric Boscherman at Radio Netherlands. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is only made possible by our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work. Listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alert, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KSKQ, Ashland, Oregon, 4ZZZ, Brisbane, Queensland, WRNC, Ashland, Wisconsin, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Join us on Sunday, March 14th, starting at noon, for a party celebrating KPFT's first broadcast 40 years ago. Celebrate KPFT's 40th birthday at the Big Top, McGonagall's Mucky Duck, 2425 Norfolk Street, just off Kirby, featuring performances from Shotgun Party, John Evans, Jack Saunders, Mike Stinson, Guy Forsythe, The Sisters Morales, Greg Trooper, Randy Weeks, The Mighty Orc, Ray Wiley, Hubbard, and more. Again, the event happens on Sunday, March 14th, starting at noon at the Big Top, McGonagall's Mucky Duck, 2425 Norfolk Street in Houston, near Richmond and Kirby. $20 tickets get you in the door. Visit kpft.org for the complete lineup and more information. This is KPFT Houston.
Friends of Mandel Park are holding their fourth annual plant sale to benefit the park. Saturday, March 27, 2010, from 9 to 1 p.m. in Mandel Park at 1501 Richmond Avenue, Houston, Texas 77006. There will be a variety of plants and trees on sale, activities for children, and tours of the garden. Enjoy breakfast by Melange Creperie and El Pablito.
Pacifica Radio. Anasot Radio Pacifica.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.